Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 405th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at UBC.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doc and the director of Program of Practice 4 at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And today we have, in our ongoing series of tools for practice around opioid use disorder, Dr. Koronic.
Hi, it's great to be here. My name is Tina. I am an associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine here at the University of Alberta and director of the peer group.
So, Mike, for me to do these podcasts every week, I have to be on heavy opioids. So, let's
scoring one right away, James. You're scoring one right away because you're using it for something other than your pain.
Yes.
So your palm eye score is already one. If you get one more positive out of the remaining five, which I know you will.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But actually, you should be switched to buprenorphine and naloxone. But yeah. I'm sure Tina will tell us that.
Yeah. So there, as Mike pointed out, we talked about sort of a tool that's used to help us figure out a little bit whether or not the person might have an opioid use disorder. But then the issue is then what do we do? And then so this tool for practice is on buprenorphine naloxone combination or Suboxone. And you guys had a look, Tina, to see does it actually do anything?
Yeah. So this question came out of, as you know, the opioid crisis that has arisen, and there was a really big push for primary care physicians to increase Suboxone prescribing or buprenorphine naloxone, as it's otherwise known. And as a group, we were curious, what is the actual evidence around this? So we determined to do a tool on it and ask the question, specifically, is buprenorphine with or without naloxone effective in opioid use disorder? So a couple of things that we looked at, when you look at, so some would call this an opioid agonist therapy, Suboxone. And when you look at opioid use disorder, sometimes there's really two Cochrane reviews. One looked at heroin users, and the other one looked at patients who had pharmaceutical opioid use disorder. So, as I mentioned in the previous podcast, we do see some primary care docs who will say, oh, well, you know, I don't really have patients with opioid use disorder. You know, if I did, they might have be addicted to, you know, codeine or something, but I'm not sure that they're the same as someone who's abusing heroin or something. So we decided to focus on the systematic review looking at patients who had pharmaceutical opioid use disorder, specifically just to try to put it into the context of every primary care doc can fit with this. So we found one Cochrane systematic review that looked at six randomized controlled trials with a total of about 600 patients who had pharmaceutical opioid dependence. So they didn't describe where the opioids came from, if they had been diverted or what have you, but that's how they were identified. And they essentially included RCTs that compared buprenorphine to detoxification or psychological treatment. So these patients had been identified as having an opioid use disorder and were either given this medication or not. And we were actually really impressed to see the numbers when we looked at them. Now, I have to just start by saying, as a group, we got together and we thought, okay, well, what do we care about? What are the patient, you know, outcomes that we would care about? And we said, well, we would be interested in mortality. We'd be interested in morbidity. Does it reduce social harms like crime or improve employability? And all those really important outcomes we didn't really find much evidence on. But what we find in this data is a lot of evidence on retention and treatment and outcomes looking at opioid use. So I'll talk a little bit about that. So if you look at retention and treatment, the use of buprenorphine results in a significant improvement in retention and treatment, with 75% of those started on the medication still in treatment, compared to 26% who were on a control intervention with a number needed to treat of 3. So that's really impressive. And I was at a talk a while ago where I heard someone talking about Suboxone, and they had said, oh, it has a number needed to treat of 2. And I was somewhat skeptical at the time. And to be honest, this is like, it's like 2.1 or something. So it's Which is pretty impressive.
I was going to say, in the bottom line, it's about a 50% absolute difference.
Almost a 50%. Yeah. It is pretty, it's just shy of that. And that's why you can't, if you're an EBM guru, you can't call it a number needed treat of two, but it is so darn close to that.
And Mike, you and I, we've talked about this before. There's only two other medications I can think of that have that absolute benefit. And it's, proton pump inhibitors and sildenafil. For some reason, sildenafil seems to come up in most of our podcasts.
In every podcast. I thought you were going to say antibiotics, but...
Well, actually, I'm going to suggest, and it depends on what antibiotics you look at. I would be surprised if the antibiotics are 50% absolute increase in benefit. It obviously depends on what you look at, but that certainly is not the case for things like otitis media. It's not a 50% absolute benefit.
No.
I mean, I think you'd even struggle to get that with pneumonia. Believe it or not, if you look at, like, even with the, you know, we've looked at, it was a while ago, and we looked at urinary tract infections. I don't even think with, you know, bladder infections, you get a 50%. You might get, 25 or 30 or 40% absolute increase in the number of people cured compared to placebo. So this is impressive.
Yeah, there's just a new trial on comparing ibuprofen versus antibiotics for UTIs. And antibiotics were clearly superior, but it wasn't 100% versus zero, for sure.
No.
Right.
Well, the nice thing about it.
Well, there you go.
I was going to say the nice thing about it, though, is for bladder infections, eventually 100% of people do get better, or almost 100%.
Yeah. General anesthesia. There's a few things that work relatively well.
Yeah.
Right. So anyways, it falls into a category of very few other drugs, for sure. So the other outcome, that was retention and treatment. The other one is substance use. Now, this was self-reported, so we know there may be some potential biases in there. However, three RCTs reported on that, and we found a significant reduction in self-reported substance abuse with 37% of patients on treatment saying they were using versus 60% not on treatment. So a number needed to treat of 5. Similarly, at the end of treatment, if they did an opioid drug screen, there was a significant reduction in the number of patients who had a positive drug screen at that time, 40% compared to 61. Again, a number needed to treat of 5. So we see a reduction in overall opioid use. They didn't find a difference in the days of unsanctioned opioid use or drug-related risk behaviors, often as reported by the patient. Unspecified adverse events, if you look at adverse events, there was 0% in the treatment group versus 8% in the control. So they didn't tell us what those were, and it's hard for us to make heads or tails of that. So the other big medication that we often hear about is methadone. So how does it compare to methadone in these type of patients? In this particular population, so again, remember, this was pharmaceutical opioid-dependent patients, there was no significant difference reported between the two with retention and treatment, substance use, risk behaviors, or adverse effects. Now, some people will argue, because I told you about the second systematic review that looked at patients who were using heroin, they did find a significant benefit with methadone, and it may just have been a numbers thing. So we've looked into that a little bit more in our guideline, which will be coming out in a little while. But as I mentioned, no data on mortality, quality of life, function, or overdose reported. And some limitations to these RCTs, they're all open label. They all had very high dropout rates. So we have to just be wary of those. So if we looked at the systematic review that included patients who were using heroin, there was 5 RCTs. Interestingly, out of those 5, 4 of the RCTs reported no opioid-related deaths. And so we kind of were saying, jeepers, in the midst of this opioid crisis, you should just join a trial, I guess, because these patients seem to be better. One of the trials did report 4 deaths in the placebo group compared to 0 in the buprenorphine group. So that was sort of, it's a bit hypothesis generating, makes you wonder, wow, I wonder if there is some effect on overall mortality. And actually, we've looked a little bit more at that since we wrote this tool, and in fact, there may be, there's at least definitely a trend towards reduction, and it may be significant. We're still working on that. What about the retention? you know, there's a lot of observational data that suggests that if you're retained in treatment, you tend to have a better quality of life. You tend to have less mortality, those types of outcomes. So a couple other just key things. So buprenorphine naloxone, it has naloxone added primarily to prevent IV abuse. So it has no impact on oral intake, but that's why it's added. Sometimes when we talk with residents, there's a bit of confusion about why the naloxone is there, and it's simply just to prevent IV abuse of that drug. So what else can we say about that? Well, we know that a fair number of people, at least a third of the people reported in Ontario who had opioid-related death, actually had opioid prescriptions that were active. So there certainly is a population of patients with prescribed opioids that are overdosing, unfortunately, and they're ones we need to identify and could look at interventions such as this. And if we look at observational studies, like I said, right now there's no RCT data specifically looking at mortality, but observational studies will suggest that there is a decreased mortality in patients who are on opioid agonist therapy. Now you could argue there's lots of confounders in that. Is it the chicken or the egg? Are you more compliant to opioid agonist therapy and therefore less likely to have problems? And observational studies have also suggested that there's lower mortality with buprenorphine naloxone as compared to methadone.
Yeah. But like you said, these are observational studies, but it still is the best available evidence. Doesn't mean it's by any stretch of the imagination perfect.
Yeah, and you know what, that's like, it's such a good point, because in this world, as we go through it, there's so many areas that are lacking evidence. So we say, well, of the evidence that we currently have, we sort of have to make, you know, some decisions or some get some idea. And yeah, currently that's the best we have is observational data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that suggests that buprenorphine may be resulting in less mortality than methadone. So in heroin users, methadone results in more treatment retention than buprenorphine. And so we've seen that a little bit. The data is fairly consistent that methadone maybe is better for retention overall, with numbers needed to treat of 4 to 10. But there are certainly prescribing restrictions around methadone, and I know some clinicians are just hesitant to use it, which may leave buprenorphine as a good option for these patients.
And I know if you the BC opioid use disorder guidelines, they do push Suboxone or the buprenorphine naloxone combination over methadone. They say it's first choice.
Yeah.
And you know,
for ease of use and access and all of the things that are that aren't necessarily captured in some of what Tina's talking about here. But you know, these patients, it's easier because of the combination, as Tina indicated, you can't convert it easily to IV use. Mm-hmm. And therefore it's easier to give carries of it and things like that.
Yeah.
So it has a lot of advantages.
Yeah. And that's, you know, just a demonstration that evidence doesn't always, is not the only thing that one looks at. You got to look at ease of use, yeah. You know, like I said, convenience, cost, and all those sorts of things. And it's, you know, how difficult is it to get, you know, these different agents and so on. And so, you know, that's the sort of the art of medicine, if you will. And that just shows that evidence is not the final determining factor. It's a lot of other things that we need to look into. But
right. And
go ahead, Mike.
There's broader issues going on here, mm-hmm. too, right? But like the issues of patient, like due to the way this crisis is occurring, many of us in practice won't see patients dying from opioid misuse and opioid use disorder. And that's a great thing that we don't mm-hmm. see it regularly, but it is still happening. And to prevent it, we need to maybe be a little more thoughtful about what we're doing and all of those kind of things. That's why the last time we talked about how do you even find these people in your practice, mm-hmm. and how do we address it? As Tina said, the majority of patients didn't have opioid prescriptions on board, but 33% is still, you know, an important number. One third of all patients have that. So we need to remember that these patients are out there and a potential serious risk in our population. And so, as you said, all of these things kind of weigh on our decision making of why would we recommend buprenorphine? Are we going to recommend everybody for methadone, which is, you know, often has wait lists, has a lot of stigma attached to it. There's lots of challenges there. Where naloxone can be initiated in it within primary care itself. And I think we're going to talk about that next.
Yeah, we sure are.
There. And just a couple of things that came up in the guideline committee that we were talking about, this debate of suboxone versus methadone first line. And I think there's evidence that both of them are effective in managing this. And it's sort of important not to lose sight of, this is an impressive treatment. So a lot of physicians kind of want to shy away from this topic, not, you know, some anyways, but this is an area where we can actually potentially make a difference. It's really it's really interesting that you have a medication with a number needed to treat of 3 for retention, reduction in drug use, what have you. There's lots of questions that remain with regards to long-term outcomes, morbidity, mortality, social outcomes that, again, still in its infancy. We'd love to see data on that. Yeah. But it is it's really an encouraging bunch of studies that and interestingly were done a few years ago, but haven't been given as much attention then as they have now, for sure.
And I think it's a very good point. I mean, numbers needed to treat of 2 to 3 compared to, you know, all the time that we spend on risk, you know, cardiovascular risk reduction, which, you know, we're talking numbers needed to treat of 50 to 100 sometimes at best. So yeah, I think you need probably less quality evidence sometimes. And again, it's the art of medicine or art of healthcare when you do that. So the issue then is, you know, sort of where do we treat those? And we have another tools for practice that looks at that.
As we have a propensity to spend extended time on these podcasts and make you listen to them over 2 or 3 different days, we're going to try and cut this one a little bit shorter, and then we're going to talk about the next topic, which is the doing the Suboxone prescribing, doing the buprenorphine prescribing in primary care in our next podcast, because there's some nuances to this. And once again, Tina will expertly lead us through.
There's actually studies.
I know. Yeah. So.
The element of surprise in your voice.
Well, no, but I mean, these things are, you know, when you look at, I mean, I think most people can wrap their heads around, oh, it's easy to do an RCT of this drug versus placebo, but there are actually randomized controlled trials looking at, you know, is there a difference between primary care and, you know, specialized opioid treatment program? And that's really, I love the fact that people do these studies to do that. So nothing majorly to sell other than the Best Science Medicine course is coming up. By the time you hear this podcast, you should be able to go register for the course. So just go to therapeuticseducation.com or .org and you will be able to register for the course. We'd love it if you could attend. It's May 3, May 4th. We got all our speakers set up and ready to go. Some really cool topics. Anything else, Mike?
Two things coming up quickly at the college. We have on February 12th, we have advanced care planning as a topic. And Dr. Alan Grill, who spent a lot of his career on this kind of thing, will be talking about that, or he certainly had a focus in it in the last few years. And then on February 25th, we'll be having a webinar with a cannabis debate with Drs. Kahan and Dr. Ware. So,
and the debate is whether you should smoke it or not. Is that what it is?
Thank you for
I was clarifying
for that, Doctor. Yeah, thank you for that, Dr. McCormick. No, it is on its utility as a medical therapy.
Yes, and it's always a great question. And we spent a little bit of time with other podcasts, so if you're interested, check those out. So thanks as always for listening.
All right. Thank you.
Talk to you later.